Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. In the past hour, the Department of Justice has indicted 12 Russian intelligence officers for hacking into Democratic National Committee emails and Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. The indictments come just days before Donald Trump is scheduled to meet with Vladimir Putin in Finland. Trump is scheduled to meet with Queen Elizabeth today as over 100,000 people take to the streets of London to protest his visit. In the UK, Donald Trump accused London Mayor Sadiq Khan of not standing up to terrorists. In an interview with The Sun, a tabloid owned by Rupert Murdoch, he said, quote, "Allowing the immigration to take place in Europe is a shame. I think it changed the fabric of Europe. And unless you act very quickly, it's never going to be what it was. And I don't mean that in a positive way," end quote. British politicians and activists call his rhetoric repulsive and racist. Joining us in about 15 minutes is Rachel Shabi. She's a journalist with The Guardian, and she's on the streets with the protesters. We will get an on-the-ground report from her. Joining us now in studio is Thomas Frank, journalist, political analyst, and historian. He is the author of several bestsellers, including What's the Matter with Kansas, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, and his most recent book is Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. Hi, Thomas. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. As we always do on our media roundtables, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So what caught your attention this week?
Well, it wasn't published this week. It was published a few weeks ago, but I've been reading Seymour Hersh's memoir. It's called Reporter, and it's the story of you know, how he became America's premier investigative reporter beginning in the Vietnam era. And it is a wonderful book. It is, I mean, the description of how he discovered the My Lai story, for example, the massacre committed by U.S. soldiers in Vietnam. Is absolutely riveting. And then, you know, you follow his career. And it takes some really peculiar twists and turns, but he is, such an admirable man. And the sort of detective work that he does to figure out these stories.
Yeah, I was listening to an interview he did on Democracy Now!, and I was just thinking about the evolution of the media since Seymour Hersh uncovered those atrocities in Vietnam.
God, yes.
And where we are today. Mm-hmm. And I just want to start off with you, because you have been writing books for so long and really critiquing the political system, not just one party, but both parties. We had Steve Almond on a couple days ago, who's a writer from New York. And he basically said, if the media had covered Donald Trump like any other politician, like a Jeb Bush, for example, there's no way he'd be in the White House today.
Yeah, and they covered him as a kind of celebrity figure. But the election of 2016, there are so many, you know, when we talk about what went wrong, the margin was so close in the critical states that Trump won, you know, in the upper Midwest. The margin was so close that you can point to, there's so many different things you can point to, mm-hmm. that made the difference. But you asked about the media, and I want to point out to you that, you know, we are a country of 320 million people, and we only have two newspapers that matter in this country, that everybody else in the media takes their lead from, either the Washington Post or the New York Times. I used to work for the Wall Street Journal, and they are a distant, you know, they don't have anywhere near the influence of those other two. It's basically those two newspapers. So this is what happens when the newspaper industry has collapsed in this country, or is in the state of collapsing. You know, you look at something like the Chicago Tribune, which was so mighty once upon a time and is now a shadow of its former self. And this country is very ill-served by that, I think. Now, I admire the reporting in the Post and the New York Times immensely. I mean, some of my friends work there. I think they're fantastic. But you look at the range of opinion that is acceptable on their op-ed pages, and it is incredibly narrow. And yet that defines the range of the permissible in this society of 320 million people. It's amazing to me. And when Seymour Hersh started out, I mean, he was working for a little fly-by-night, some fly-by-night news service. There's a photograph of him in their office, and it didn't have any furniture, you know. And yeah, those days are gone.
Do you think that the public understands what's at stake with all of this? I mean, because when we talk about media, obviously there's many different kinds of media. But Steve Almond in his book said, look, yes, there's so much blame to go around with the cable shows, but even the New York Times were obsessed over the emails at a time when Trump didn't release his tax returns.
I know. It was totally disproportionate. The stuff about Hillary Clinton's emails. Yes. It was. Can I tell you a funny story? It's actually not funny. So I went to the poll. I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, and I went and voted for Hillary, and I did early voting, you know, and I come back out to my car and I turn on the ignition. The radio was on, set to NPR, and they said, we have breaking news. You know, James Comey has reinstated the investigation. You know, the famous memo where they found Anthony Weiner's laptop. And it was just like, you know, my heart sank. I knew then that Trump was, you know, and the fact that Trump bounced back from, I mean, there are so many different factors here. The mm-hmm. fact that Trump bounced back from that incredible, the groping tape, mm-hmm. I still can't believe that happened. But, you know, I wrote at great length about the 2016 campaign while it was happening. In fact, if you ask me, there's no excuse for the Hillary campaign ignoring what was obviously going on, that Trump was reaching out to the white working class in the same way that George Bush did and Ronald Reagan did and Richard Nixon did before him. The Republicans always do this, and they always do it. Well, Trump was slightly different, you know, did it in a slightly different way than the others. But this was totally visible. You could see it very easily. And there's no excuse for the Clinton machine to have taken no notice of this. Mm. I was not the only one writing about this at the time. There were many people pointing this out, including Hillary Clinton's husband. And they still, you know, and Bernie Sanders, for Pete's sake. They didn't pay any attention.
Mm. And I think that we'll be analyzing this for probably years to come. I mean, I'm curious to see how the media covers the midterms. I'm hoping it's not he's ahead, she's ahead, like they always
yeah,
do.
Yes, that's right. And it's also covering him as a celebrity. And so there's this sense in which, you know, we're entranced by the spectacle of the thing and the you know, it's like looking at a snake and you get, you know, what's the famous expression? And you get sort of mesmerized, you know. And there's that aspect to it. This is a man who, I mean, the newspapers of this country, such as they are, you know, what's left of them, endorsed Hillary by this incredible, overwhelming margin. But at the same time, so they were almost unanimously, you know, in favor of her, and in fact supported her in the news stories in a way that I've never seen before. But right. at the same time, were fascinated by this guy in the, you know, and in some ways, Trump is the product of decades of celebrity culture. He is. So can I tell you another story? So we've got a book of mine here on the table, Rendezvous with Oblivion. It's a collection of essays from the last couple of years. And as I was putting this book together, going through my essays from the last 8 years or so, everything I would read points to Trump. Mm-hmm. Even before, I didn't even know who the guy was. Mm-hmm. I didn't care about him. I didn't pay any attention to him. But everything points to him. And if you think about it, he is in so many ways the culmination of all of these ugly trends in our society that we have been on for a long time. I mean, Trump himself is like a man of the 1980s, you know, and of the celebrity culture of that period. He talks like that. He thinks like that. Mm-hmm. And that's really who he is. Mm-hmm. He is – they covered him as a kind of, you know, garish celebrity or a pro wrestling person, by the way. Yeah, well, we'll talk about that later.
Well, and also when you look at how his trip to the UK is being covered – the media just keep doing the same thing. He said this and then he walked back.
Yeah.
So I want to just give this trip a little bit of context because I was thinking, you know, what's the best way to cover this right now? And then I was thinking about his first trip to Poland, which is really important. Donald Trump and his first trip to Europe goes to Poland. And this was last July. And I'm reading Peter Beinart in The Atlantic. In his speech in Poland, Donald Trump referred 10 times to the, quote, West and 5 times to our, quote, civilization. His white nationalist supporters will understand exactly what he means. It's important that other Americans do, too. The West is not a geographic term. Poland is further east than Morocco. France is further east than Haiti. Australia is further east than Egypt. The West is not an ideological or economic term either. no one considers them part of the West. The West
Poland?
Is a
wait a minute. They're a member of NATO now.
Well, it's just the West is a racial and religious term. That's yeah, what he's getting at.
I think that's right. But I can't stand that kind of casual. People use the term the Western Civ all the time. I mean, it's a college course.
But beyond that, the fact that he went to Poland to talk about civilization and the West sends a very strong message.
Yep. Oh, absolutely. He's reaching out not only to his kind of white nationalist followers, but I think he's trying to Poland also has a very Trump-friendly administration right now, what is called in Europe populist, which, by the way, is a term that I absolutely drives me up the wall. Mm-hmm. We can talk about that later, why that annoys me so much. But that's a regime that is the kind of thing that Trump wishes he could do here in the United States. Hungary as well, I think.
And just recently, Poland removed 27 of their Supreme Court justices.
Yeah, that's right. That's the kind of thing, the kind of move I think Trump wishes he could do. Thank goodness he can't. By the way, can I say a word about populism, which is a
thrown around.
I know, and the Europeans use this to mean racist tyranny. They use it as a synonym for what we would call fascism or proto-fascism. But I'm from Kansas. Populism there is a reform movement in the 19th century that was exactly the opposite of those things. That was like, you know, really poor farmers getting together to fight Wall Street and to fight the railroads, to fight monopolies. It was not that at all. And the way the word has migrated from meaning something really wonderful to meaning something really awful is absolutely fascinating. And I also think I think irresponsible for people to use the word in that way. Now, I myself have used it for years to describe right wingers. You know, I've been writing about this, about right wing populism, mm-hmm. for 20 years, Rose. We did a special issue of my magazine, The Baffler, on this subject in like 1999. Oh. I've been fascinated by it my entire adult life. Mm. And here we are. And it, you know, oh well. I mean, I could talk about this forever, but I'm shutting up now.
Thomas Frank is a journalist and best-selling author. You remember his book, What's the Matter with Kansas? His newest book is Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. And now I would like to welcome Rachel Shabby to the show. Rachel is a journalist, broadcaster, and contributing writer to The Guardian. She's also author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. And she joins us from the streets of London, where she's been covering the protests. Hi, Rachel. Welcome to the show.
Hello there. How are you?
Hi. Well, we're going to see if we can get a decent line with you. Why don't we just try it? Rachel, I understand that over 100,000 people are taking to the streets today to protest Donald Trump?
Oh, yeah, it's more than that. I mean, the police were estimating 250,000 in London alone. And as you know, protests have been going on nationwide around the country. Basically, wherever Trump shows up, so do whole crowds of protesters, making it clear to him that he's not welcome in the UK.
Did you say 250,000 people are on the streets?
That was the police estimate I heard earlier for the London rally. Now, that's not confirmed, but definitely I was there. It was enormous. It was one of the biggest protests I've seen. It was probably the biggest I've seen since the 2003 protest against the Iraq war, which of course was also part of a international demonstrations around the world. But I haven't seen anything like that on London streets since until today. So Trump, in a sense, he has united us and he has unified us in opposition to him today.
Rachel Shabby is on the streets of London, and sorry about her line, but she did walk a couple of miles to do this interview to take a break from the protests, so hopefully it'll improve. Rachel, we were talking about the coverage of the protests and Trump's visit to the UK here in the United States, and basically what we're getting is the interview he did with The Sun, the Murdoch tabloid, and then, you know, saying things about Theresa May, the racist things he said about London Mayor Sadiq Khan. And then he says, you know, I actually like Theresa May. And so that's what we're getting here in the U.S. How is his visit and the racist comments that he's made in the U.K. being covered in the U.K. press?
Well, most of the UK press, I have to say, people are absolutely horrified. I mean, regardless of what they might have thought before about Trump, the idea of him giving an interview to a very high circulation newspaper in the UK, where he basically trash talked his host, right? He dissed the Prime Minister of this country, Theresa May. He undermined her. He undermined her in very important Brexit negotiations. He made some awful racist remarks about a very popular London mayor, and he trash-talked a city, London, where, you know, we're very proud of our diversity and our multiculturalism. So, you know, it was greeted with horror, actually. People were really not impressed that he would do that. And especially not to the person who'd invited him on this visit.
This has been a very chaotic and consequential week for politics in the UK. Just to remind listeners, last year, actually June of 2016, 51% of British voters voted for the UK to withdraw from the European Union. And this week, Boris Johnson quit as Foreign Secretary. David Davis resigned as Brexit Secretary. Steve Baker walked out as a junior Brexit Minister, and a couple other Tory MPs have quit. What explains these resignations?
Well, ever since the decision to leave the European Union 2 years ago, the government has really been in chaos over and divided over how to negotiate that exit. The referendum was a decision to leave, but it wasn't. That was all that could be interpreted from the result. It didn't say how to leave. And the government is very, very deeply divided about the EU. It is a chaotic and very fundamental and visceral split in the Conservative Party. They cannot seem to reconcile the divisions between them over people who, you know, still want a strong and consistent economic and trade relationship with the EU, and on the other side, a sort of hard right-wing component of the party that wants a hard right-wing break with the EU, and that part is of the party is the part that's aligned with Trump. So, you know, we're kind of trying to see, starting to see the geopolitics of it play out as well, that it's not just a political disruption that's playing out in the UK. It also speaks to a wider geopolitical disruption that is about a sort of emboldened far right that, you know, doesn't like the EU, doesn't like internationalism, doesn't like human rights, doesn't like immigration, doesn't believe there's such a thing as climate change, and wants this kind of race to the bottom in terms of removing all kinds of tax and protections and unemployment that exist. And that is the element that is allied with Trump. And I think that's why we're seeing so much resistance to him on the streets in the UK, that it's not just about him in and of himself. It's about a wider movement that he represents and is being so resoundingly rejected today.
Mm. And what are you hearing on the streets today, almost 2 years after the Brexit vote? What are you hearing from people about Brexit?
People are incredibly frustrated about Brexit, and that's across, you know, it doesn't matter whether people voted to leave or to remain. Confidence in the Prime Minister's capacity to get Britain a good deal from the European Union, from the EU, is at rock bottom. So whichever way people voted, across the board, nobody has any confidence in her capacity to deliver. And obviously that has tumbled in the last few weeks in the aftermath of this incredible chaos within the government itself, with, as you say, the Brexit minister and then the foreign minister and some other officials resigning from the party in protest over the government's attempts to kind of soften its stance with the EU, and not even softening it that much, but certainly enough to trigger this rebellion within its own ranks. So people are incredibly disillusioned with the whole process. And regardless of how people voted, there is that sense of frustration and exasperation that we are in this kind of gridlock over this issue 2 years down the line.
And Rachel, how is the European media covering the rise of the far right across Europe and how it's connected to Donald Trump and people like Steve Bannon? Because Politico reports that a day before Trump arrived, leaders of Europe's rough-edged populist movement, again, there's that word populist, Thomas, filed into a five-star hotel in London's Mayfair district to see Steve Bannon. He set up a war room of sorts in a conference room at the hotel to conspire with leaders of Europe's surging populist movement. Bannon's goal, he said in a brief interview between meetings, is to, quote, contextualize Trump for a European audience that hates him. And then the Politico article says it's a reminder that Europe's version of Trumpism is thriving from England to France to Italy, even if Trump himself may not make much of a splash when he arrives on Thursday night.
Yeah, I mean, I think it sort of links to what we were talking about earlier, the fact that there is this attempt amongst the populist far right to join dots, and definitely these movements were emboldened and encouraged by the Brexit vote, and then a few months later, Trump becoming US president. We know that there are far-right elements across Europe, you know, from Hungary to Italy, to France, to Austria, who all are very much in line with Trump when it comes to a very sort of racist, essentially far-right populist take on immigration, hysteria, scaremongering, lying, quite commonly associating migrants with things like crime, which is a classic far-right thing to do. So we've seen these attempts to link up and empower and embolden each other and sort of bolster the political popularity of one to the other. And I think that Europe is canny to that. I mean, definitely the European Union is aware of that. And I think that's part of the disappointment that comes with Britain's decision to leave the EU, that it is, you know, it's a major country, it's a major player in a European context. And we have almost a country that is almost sort of opting out of this fight against the far right by its withdrawal from the EU.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for leaving the protest to join us, and thanks for your reporting.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel Shabi is a journalist and contributing writer to The Guardian. She's author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. And she joined us from the protests in London, where 250,000 people have turned out. Trump actually did not go to London. He is quoted as saying that the Trump baby blimp made him feel unwelcome in London. It's a baby blimp that has
I love it. I want one of those.
Well, Thomas, what do you, just before the break,
you have like a hot air balloon and fly over, you know, Washington.
Well, that's what a lot of people are saying. If it makes him feel uncomfortable and not welcome and he's not even going to London, that says something.
Yeah, but you know this guy. He'll say anything. It doesn't, you know, the reality doesn't mean anything to this guy. Can I tell you something? I went to England last year. The Guardian brought me over there to talk to Brexit voters in the north of England, the totally deindustrialized part of Yorkshire. And not totally deindustrialized, but this is the place where you might remember when I was younger, they had an enormous coal miners' strike, you know, this war with Margaret Thatcher. Mm-hmm. And she just came down like a ton of bricks on these people. And this is, and their lives have suffered. I mean, their towns are, they look like little Detroits, you know? And I met lots of people in these towns, talked to lots of people in these towns who voted for Brexit, and almost all of them were on the left. It was kind of interesting. And so Theresa May, the election, the campaign for her, you know, was going on for the parliamentary elections was going on at the time. You know, she called this snap election. And her whole plan was to play the Donald Trump and to peel off these parts of the north of England that were very pro-Labour, meaning Labour Party, and to peel them off and win them over for the Conservatives using Brexit as her tool, because these people had all voted for Brexit in their ruined towns and their ruined lives. And here's the hilarious thing. They didn't go for it. They went for Corbyn in a huge way. I would talk to people that, you know, and I'd say, well, like, what Theresa May's strategy to get you to vote for the Conservatives, is that going to work? And they'd be like, vote for the Tories? Like, never. Never in a million years would we, you know, they might vote for Brexit. Hmm. You know, they might have all sorts of views, but they would never vote for the party of Thatcher. It was fascinating. Hmm. Interesting people.
Thomas Frank is a journalist and author of many bestsellers, including What's the Matter with Kansas? His latest is Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A, a daily conversation about the most important issues of our time. Our goal is to be a kind of national mirror, to take the time and help America look deeply at itself and ask what it wants to be. Now you can hear 1A weekday mornings at 11, right after Your Call with Rose Aguilar, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call. On the phone, by sending an email to yourcall@kalw.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Thomas Frank, longtime journalist and historian, the author of many bestsellers, including What's the Matter with Kansas, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, and his most recent book is Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. Thomas, you have so much experience, as you said, writing about the far right in this country, spending so much time in Kansas. And
I'm from there.
You're from Kansas. Yeah. So really, I mean, it's so interesting when you think about how the media woke up after the election and said, where did we go wrong? Well, you've been writing about this for a very long time. And I noticed that most of your columns are in the Guardian. You're a columnist for The Guardian now.
Correct. I write for a British newspaper. And when I don't write for them, I'm writing for Le Monde Diplomatique, which is a French newspaper. The only American publication I write for anymore is Harper's Magazine, which is not on the internet, so sorry.
Right.
I mean, they are on the internet, but you can't. It's difficult.
You have to subscribe.
And exactly. You have to read it in paper.
And so I've noticed that I haven't really heard you on public radio. I haven't seen you on the cable shows.
Never. Almost never. No, I'm not on the cable show. I was on CNN a few times. It was a fairly conservative host that had me on, Smirkanish. And he used to have me on during the 2016 campaign to sort of laugh at me. And then to his enormous credit, he had me on the day after the election and said, now we're going to hear from a guy who was right.
Hmm.
But he's the only one. Other than that, no, I'm not on in the American media very often anymore.
You live in D.C.
I live in D.C.
What are you hearing from the media bubble in D.C. about who gets on and who doesn't and how these decisions are made?
So, Rose, I don't know how the decisions are made, but I've been writing about this for 20 years. I know this subject of right-wing populism extremely well. And the American media is not interested in my take on this. And in my basically, look, I look at American politics through the prism of class. I write about social class, so working class people, professional class people. The great problem in our country is that the media, the people who run the media and who are, you know, who design the programming for the media, all come, and by and large, the audience for the media that we're talking about, the sort of right thinking, you know, upscale media, it's all the same. They all come from the same group. They are all members of this sort of affluent, white collar, highly credentialed professional class, and that happens to also be the class that dominates the Democratic Party. As I've said before, I think I've even said it on your show, the Democratic Party is a class party. It's just not the working class. And this is a message that, by and large, the people who run the American media, if I can guess about this, I don't know since I'm not privy to their thinking, they don't want to hear that message. Mm-hmm. To talk about American politics in terms of class is extremely distasteful to them. And they do not want to hear it, and they don't hear it.
So how do you—
and by the way, the consequence of that is that this is going to go on and on and on and on.
When you look at class with Trump bringing race into that, because we're now getting a lot of studies, professors are coming out with reports about how once again, the media really got it wrong by saying that the reason why so many white people voted for Trump is because they're on economic hard times. But when you look at the numbers, a lot of middle upper class people voted for Trump, whereas a lot
of they're Republicans. That's
Republicans.
Yeah, that's who they are.
But race played a very big factor in their decision to vote for Trump.
Absolutely.
The other thing, one more thing, is when you look at statistics and studies, some element of the Trump voter still believes that Obama was born in Kenya and believes these very right-wing talking points. How do you feel like the national NPR, New York Times, that kind of media are reporting on the racial element of all of this?
They're obsessed with it. That's all they talk about. The thing about that Trump voters having a genuine economic grievance, that's what I say. They completely don't want to hear that. That means criticizing NAFTA and things. They love NAFTA. And to criticize NAFTA is absolutely unacceptable to them. Now, I want to point out to you what you say about the racism of Trump voters is obviously absolutely correct. But there's another factor, too, and that is that these people live in – you know how I was just describing the people in Brexit. So another essay in Rendezvous with Oblivion is me going to Walt Disney's hometown in Marceline, Missouri, about 100 miles north of Kansas City, and visiting the small towns around there. I chose that because that's emblematic. You know, that's Main Street, USA. And it is in a state of economic ruination. And this is an area that was heavily Democratic at one time. This is Missouri, Harry Truman country. You know, Dick Gephardt is from there. And these people have become Republicans as their lives went through the meat grinder, which is just an incredible thing. And yeah, there is tons of racism involved in this, and it gets mingled in with the economic grievance in a way that's really disgusting and loathsome. But the economic grievance is there. And I would call your attention to – there's been lots of studies that point this out as well. And the one that – well, let me put it this way. 2016 was an explosive year across the board. It was volcanic. And you had Trump, but you also had Bernie Sanders, who was reaching to a lot of these same voters. And once he was eliminated, I hate to say it, many of them did go for Trump, made an overt pitch to these people, and he won a lot of them over. And it is disturbing to me and it's distressing to me, but it happened. So the question is, what do you do about that now? And there's two answers. Well, there's two ways, I guess three ways of looking at it. One is you do nothing, which is what the Democratic Party wants to do. Hmm. Do nothing. One is bid for the bigot vote, which I think is absolutely unacceptable. You cannot do that. But by the way, the Democratic Party has done that in the past, and not a long time ago. I mean Bill Clinton, Hillary's husband. That's what the welfare reform bill was. That's what the crime bill of 1994 was. It was a bid for the bigot vote. That is flatly unacceptable to me. The way you win these – the only way you're – if you ask me, the only way you're going to win these votes, a way that is acceptable to people on the left like me to win these voters back is to speak to them in terms of social class, that is, you know, on economic issues. You know, look, we – or I shouldn't say we because I'm not really much of a Democrat anymore. I mean I'm registered and although I vote for Democrats, but – The way that a party of the left reaches out to working people is not with culture war issues, is not with racist dog whistle messages. It's by talking about jobs and the economy and trade and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's how you do it. And the fact that that the Democratic Party is reluctant to do that, doesn't want to do that, is uncomfortable doing that, that is disastrous. I mean, what kind of left party is that?
Well, they in addition to that, they also have to talk about racial justice.
Of course.
As we're seeing hate crimes go up and white people calling the cops for black people.
Oh, isn't that just disgusting?
Going about their everyday lives.
Can I tell you another story? So Listen Liberal has a lot about that because I wrote it before Black Lives Matter's Black Lives Matter had happened, and I was, you know, it's a history of the Democratic Party's move to the right, and a big part of it is about Bill Clinton's presidency. And when I started researching the crime bill of 1994, I couldn't believe what I was finding. It is so loathsome to me, so reprehensible, so disgusting. And I remember this is, like I said, before Black Lives Matter had come on the scene. And so I remember calling up an expert, you know, to get her opinion about, you know, about the crime bill of 1994 and what its impact had been on, you know, on black youth specifically. And they were locked up in huge numbers, as you remember. And she said, you know, we discussed it and talked about it and I got her opinion on this and that. And she said at the end of the conversation, you know, you're never going to be able to make people care. And that was the challenge to me, because people, Americans, didn't care. They were just locking up a generation of kids. And that's what I wrote that book with, that anger in my well, you can read it in the book, that between the lines. Mm-hmm. And yes, I am absolutely 100% behind that movement to, you know, Black Lives Matter and to stop police brutality and to end mass incarceration. I absolutely hate those things. But at the same time, I am very pro-labor. Mm-hmm. Those things don't conflict.
Well, no,
Rose.
They don't. You don't. They don't. And every we do so many shows about the prison system and ending mass incarceration, and poverty has to come up.
Absolutely.
With all of those conversations.
Yep. But we can have both.
And lack of opportunity.
Yes, we can have all those things. And a party that does all those things is a party that will succeed in this age of inequality, that a party that will – you could end right-wing populism once and for all. And in fact, we had – okay, another one of my great talking points. We had that chance when Obama came in, mm-hmm. in 08 and 09, and he had the world at his back, and here's Wall Street begging for him to help them out, you know? And he did. And he never cracked down on them. And he never fired those people. And he never took their banks apart. And he never took that institution apart. And he had the power, you know, with the bailouts. He had votes on their board. He had seats on their board. He could have fired their director. He could have done all of that stuff. It was all possible. It was in our hands. And it slipped through our fingers, that extraordinary chance. Mm. And now we're back to where we started. That's what – you know, when we talk about things that disgust us about Trump, that's the thing that gets me, is that we are back to Nixon. We are back to Reagan. We are back to George W. Bush. And we had the chance to end this. Mm. And I don't know if that chance is ever going to come again.
Well, and when you look
at – he's on the march. You're just talking about him in Europe. This is like – it is going and going and going. And in some ways, it is the product of our team's failure. I shouldn't say our team, because you and I aren't responsible. I think we're on the good side on these questions. But it is a product of our team's failure to do what was obviously necessary during the financial crisis. Mm. At the moment of opportunity. Do you remember that Rahm Emanuel, a man I don't really admire, he said, "You never let a good crisis go to waste." That is what we did.
Thomas Frank is a longtime journalist. His latest book is Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. Dr. Frank, I'm a huge fan of yours, and I wanted to ask you about what happened between the Democrats, particularly the post-Watergate Democrats and organized labor. I have a theory that the Democrats who came into power in the 70s, who cut their teeth in the anti-war movement, never really forgave George Meany and Lane Kirkland and the anti-communist leadership of the AFL-CIO, and that led to their indifference, if not actual hostility, to traditional organized labor. And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
I share your suspicion, and it's more than a suspicion. They hated organized labor. It came out of the Vietnam War when a lot of the leadership of the AFL-CIO supported President Johnson on Vietnam. And I think that was, well, obviously a mistake on their part. And I can understand why people looked at organized labor in the late 60s and early 70s and saw an ossified institution that you know, couldn't do anything right and that was very white and very undemocratic. And they came to despise it. And what the mistake that they made when they did that, and the Democratic Party did basically eject organized labor from its position of power in the early 1970s. When they did that, they didn't understand that they were also closing off working class voices at the same time. And the Democratic Party made a historic shift away from working people. Now, they did it with good intentions. George McGovern was a good guy, and he thought he was doing the right thing. But historically, in the long term, that has proven to be an incredible mistake. Now, then there's also a basic class difference, because the people who were, coming out of college campuses and taking over the Democratic Party in the early 70s were the same people who are running it today, this affluent, white-collar, highly educated group of people. And basically, they are not sympathetic to the concerns of working class people. It is a fundamental class divide, and they can't see it, and they don't want to talk about it. And this is why, you know, inequality gets worse and worse and worse, whether it's a Democrat in charge or whether it's a Republican in charge, because they simply don't care about working class issues. Look at Bill Clinton getting NAFTA done. Look at Barack Obama, who was elected with massive support from organized labor. He comes into office and they have one item they want from him, the Employee Free Choice Act. And he's like, oh, see you later, guys. And it's catastrophic. You don't, you know, if you want to build the left in this country, and you should if you're a Democratic politician, then you make it easier to form unions, you know, and you help your support movement out. You build the social movement that's behind you. You don't, you know, stiff arm them, which is what Democratic politicians do. And the irony of all this is they do this and they expect, you know, there's this complacency. People like Labor have nowhere else to go, they say.
Right.
And here's Donald Trump and the Republicans and Steve Bannon, who we've mentioned now several times, this kind of evil genius behind this all, saying, we're going to give them a place to go.
Right.
We're going to dream something up. We're going to figure out some way and give them a place to go. And it worked.
And a number of union members who voted for Obama voted for Trump.
There's a lot of them who did. A lot of them who didn't, too.
Right.
I mean, but I know three people.
States.
That, yes, that's right.
Right.
I know people who voted for Obama twice and voted for Trump. And I, you know, the Washington Post just did this beautiful story. And by the way, I'm very critical of the Post's op-ed page in Rendezvous with Oblivion, but their news reporting is still wonderful, beautiful. Mm-hmm. They did a 10,000-word story about these counties in the upper Midwest that have voted for Democrats for, you know, decades and went for Trump. And they went to these counties and interviewed these people. And lo and behold, it's exactly what I was just describing in small town Missouri. It's ruination.
Mm.
And these people went for Trump out of a kind of desperation. You know, it is like the hope. In, you know, in French, the word for hope is espoir. And the word for desperation is désespoir. And it's the opposite. And it's kind of the opposite of what got Obama elected. Mm. And you see that all over this country. This is not to excuse Donald Trump. I can't stand the man. He's repugnant. He's ruining my life. You know, I'm a very happy person, Rose, and I wake up in the morning and the sun is shining and the birds are singing and the flowers are in bloom, and I go out in my driveway and pick up the newspaper and I'm like, oh, hell.
Yeah, or like those of us on our phone that get the breaking news because we're 3 hours behind you.
Yeah.
So when we wake up, we've got 10
you've got a long
news
list.
Alerts. This happens every single day. Thank you for calling, Phil. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Well, you're going to hate me for the feedback if you can tolerate it.
Can you turn off your radio?
I'll just turn it off. Just a second.
All right. Greg in Palo Alto. He's one of our favorite callers.
Okay.
Hi, Greg.
Well,
there you
are. I just want to say a couple of things. One is, shortly after Trump got elected, I started to think about this, and I think you've maybe already discussed it, but it seemed to me that Obama didn't do anything for the people who voted for Trump. And that's one of the reasons they voted for Trump. In the 8 years that he was in, he didn't do a heck of a lot for them and for most of the country, as far as I'm concerned. And so he dropped the ball. And here we are at the national level with this insanity that we're going to have to deal with. But I want to also ask you about California. I don't know how much you know about California. The Democrats
I hear it's
in California.
Nice.
The problem with it here is we have a seemingly progressive state, okay, progressive Democrats, and yet we can't get them to tackle issues like out here, Prop 13. They really aren't really that great on the environment as far as I'm concerned. And so I'm wondering why, you know, here we have a progressive, supposedly Democratic assembly and Senate, a governor, and we can't even get it done in California. So I don't know how this is going to get turned around. It's not going to happen internally in the Democratic Party, as far as I can see. So I wonder what your views are on that.
Okay, three really good questions. The Democratic Party, this is why I wrote Listen Liberal, and this is why I the journalism that I do. Why is the Democratic Party consistently such a disappointment? Why do they never tackle the issues that are obviously – I mean, this country is coming apart economically. The middle class is diminishing in this country before our eyes. And it's it is shocking and it's horrifying. And, you know, I'm 53 years old. When I was a kid, that was the pride of being an American. We were the great middle class society. And that is crumbling before our eyes. Why don't they do something about it? It's because that's not who they are. That is not who the Democrats are. They are, first and foremost, a party that cares about the affluent, highly educated, white-collar, professional class. And these are people who, by and large, have done very well as inequality has increased and the middle class has come apart. They've done extremely well. And what was it Hillary Clinton said a couple of months ago when she was on tour in India? And she said, I took the areas that produced like two-thirds of the American GNP. She's proud of that, that the Democrats are now a party of the affluent. She's proud of that. And no, you constantly expect them to do these things for, you know, for the middle class and working people, and they don't, they never deliver, and it's extremely frustrating. And they sit back and say, you've got, you, voter, you, caller, have nowhere else to go.
Right.
Now, then talking about Obama and how he failed, I want to give you a very specific example because it's, you know, we can talk about it in generalities and how he failed in a general sense or didn't do enough in a general sense, and that led to Trump. But it also happened in an highly particular way. And what I'm referring to is, and nobody remembers this anymore, how Obama beat Hillary in 2008. And it happened in Iowa, the Iowa caucuses. It was a huge surprise. You remember Obama came out of nowhere, you know, this Illinois state. He was a senator at the time and beat Hillary Clinton, the best-known Democrat in America. And the way he did it was Obama understood farm issues from his time in the Illinois legislature. And he went to all these farmers in Iowa and said, I'm going to start enforcing antitrust. And it is going to, you know, because farmers are really in the grip of these powerful corporations and small towns are, you know, Walmart, you know what I'm talking about, or whoever your local chicken processor is or whatever it happens to be. They are in the grip of monopoly like in the 19th century. And here Obama says, I'm going to help you out. He completely dropped. He did nothing on that issue. Another thing he said, this one is really going to blow your mind. Obama said, I'm going to renegotiate NAFTA. Because it has an escape clause in it, and the president can do it unilaterally. And then, of course, he changed 180 degrees on that as president and started pushing for the TPP instead. And here's Trump comes along and basically takes Obama's exact rhetoric and uses it against Hillary. And this is tragic is what it is.
And he pushed her in a corner because she couldn't say, yes, people are not doing well. Well, 8 years
of
Obama.
Because she is the handpicked successor of Barack Obama. Now, there's evidence that Hillary knows this, that she knew it at the time, but she was boxed in. Sometimes I wonder if Trump is a strategic genius or just got incredibly, incredibly lucky, because trade was exactly the issue to undermine Hillary, because it was her husband that got NAFTA done and she was Secretary of State when the TPP was negotiated. And try as she may to get out of it, and she did try. You know, she said, I've changed my mind about it. I don't think it's a good idea anymore. She couldn't escape it. And it really hurt her.
Thank you, Greg. Let's hear next from Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
I was just really, there this morning, you know.
It's really good to listen to him, to Dr. Frank. And I'm an old lady. I've been around a long time, and I basically am a socialist. And I hated Clinton. And my feeling about Obama is that he was just a coward. He would have made a really good president of a university, but he just, and I've been disappointed for so many years, but I'm at a loss. You know, the only way I get through to be able to sleep at night is by listening to Stephen Colbert before I go to bed. And I just don't know what to do anymore. I mean,
okay. Well, you can't give up, all right? Let me just say that you can't give up. And second of all, let me say, and I share this with Colbert that even as we look at the ship sinking, and that's the image on the cover of Rendezvous with Oblivion, there's still. I take a lot of pleasure in it. So the essays in Rendezvous with Oblivion are kind of fun, and there's a lot of humor in it because life is okay, and there's a lot of humor to be seen in all of these things,
Yes, I mean, if you can put food on the table, and that's what's so...
And remember, the economy is doing really well right now. It's, I don't want to be too negative about this, but I think it's – I study history or used to study history anyways, and it is important to understand that we had a great opportunity in this country a few years ago, and we blew it. And I you know, I don't know if I want to blame Obama or I want to blame his advisors. He was a relative newbie to politics. He'd only been in the Senate for 2 years. Mm. And he's I voted for him twice. I really liked the guy. I thought he was the greatest orator I've ever seen. I had really high hopes for him. And yes, I was profoundly disappointed by his presidency. But look, if we can say one positive thing about Donald Trump, at least he is getting people out in the streets. 200,000 people in London. I went to the women's rally in Washington the day after his inauguration. I've never seen anything like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not old enough to remember the anti-Vietnam War protests. That was incredible to me. And that is a hopeful thing.
Just quickly, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez victory in New York
has
a lot of people wondering, though, can, let's say, 5 more Democratic socialists win House seats? Can they change the Democratic Party from within?
Absolutely. We have seen how parties – so third parties are basically off the table anymore, that you can't go that route anymore because of the laws in this country. You have to work within the party. It can be done. I've seen it with my own eyes. I saw it in Kansas. I saw how the right-wingers took over the Republican Party, and the whole country saw it when Trump did it to the Republicans, you know, defeating Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, et cetera, et cetera. That was incredible. It can happen in the Democratic Party as well, and let's hope it does.
Final thoughts, Thomas. I think the thing that's difficult is it's our job to really – dig into the issues. And we did a lot of shows that were critical of the Democrats last year, the year before, as we should. People get mad about that because all of a sudden we get Donald Trump. And the thing about Trump is, you know, you say, yes, there's all these hopeful things, which there is, but the most vulnerable are getting hit the hardest.
No question.
And so how do we deal with this? Because as you said, the Dems know there's no third party that you can go for other than not voting, which 100 million people did.
Yeah.
And being so disenchanted, gerrymandering, voter suppression, I mean, there's so many other factors involved in this.
Yeah. Yes, I know. And it is deeply frustrating. Okay, the first thing you said first, to criticize the Democrats, does that mean that you're empowering Trump? No, that's your duty as a journalist, is to, you know, to investigate and hold people accountable. That is what we do. I vote for Democrats. I voted for Hillary. But I am not – you know, I'm not an employee of the Democratic Party. You know, I don't work for those people. My job is to hold them accountable, to question, to understand where we've been and where we're going. You give that up and all is lost.
Right. And I mean, they're the ones that are talking about Russia 24/7. And Chuck Schumer said, if you lose a working class Democrat, you can pick up a moderate Republican.
Oh, Chuck, because he doesn't understand. There are a lot more working class people. There are affluent, you know, suburban professionals.
Well, and then after Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's victory, Pelosi, I just want to get the right quote here. Pelosi said, each of our members is elected to be the independent rep of their district. So nobody's district is representative of somebody else's district.
And here we are in her district.
Exactly.
I'm here to tell you, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she is awesome. And I'm from Kansas. She would play well in Kansas. I think we would like her there.
Hmm. Thomas Frank is a longtime journalist, author of many bestsellers, including What's the Matter with Kansas, Listen Liberal, and his newest, Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. Thomas Frank, it's always great to have you in studio.
It's my pleasure, Rose.
Thank you so much for joining us. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter to find out what's coming up at Your Call Radio. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.